Previously on Falling Low.
All of a sudden, boom!
The next thing I know, I'm flying across the table. There is a ball of fire coming. My clothes were burnt and very bloody from the cuts.
Oh my God, it's been a plane crash.
They just kept saying, everything's gone. It's all gone. And I could not wrap my head around that. I just could not imagine. Are there posts left? What does that mean, everything's gone? How can everything be gone?
After surviving the explosion and fire that destroyed their farm on December 9th, 1968, my mom, Sigrid, who was 15 at the time, was still at the hospital with my grandpa Pete after receiving stitches for her injuries. My Uncle Mike and my Uncle Martin stayed late on the farm working with the National Guard and rescue crews. But late that evening, they stayed with my great Uncle Alfred, who lived half a mile directly east of Falling Low. My Aunt Ingeborg and Grandma Marie were about to leave the hospital as families started to pour in. My double cousin, Rebecca, reads from my Grandma Marie's written account.
At 10:30 that evening, Ingeborg and I left the hospital and went to the home of Mary and Laverne Freddy to spend the night. Sleep was impossible, but prayers of thanks for saving my family and prayers of help needed in the days and weeks to come helped me calm down. My sister Gertrude and her husband Sigurd arrived from New Ulm, Minnesota about 2 o'clock during the night, and it was so good to see them.
My great aunt Gert, who was my grandma Marie's sister, and my great uncle Sig, who was my grandpa Pete's brother, drove down from Minnesota that night as soon as they heard. Their son Jerry was with them. My Aunt Ingeborg recalls that first night after having lost everything in the explosion.
So eventually we got shuffled off to Mary Freddy's home on North Elm Street. We just didn't know what else to do. There wasn't room out at Alfred and Henrietta's because, you know, all the men were out there and Gert and Sig were on their way. I don't know who else we would have stayed with. Mom and I went there eventually, and again, you know, lack of toothbrushes, jammies, all that kind of stuff was just, it was just surreal.
Our pastor, Paul Peterson, and my niece Judy and Paul Helland from Waterloo came early Tuesday morning. There were many, many people around, but family is special at trying times as this.
My Aunt Ingeborg was actually able to get a few hours of sleep.
And I do remember waking up the next morning and seeing the headlines from the Des Moines Register, airplane crashes on farm to die. And I thought they were talking about Sigurd and Dad. I was just absolutely, I thought, oh my gosh, they died last night and nobody told me. And of course, realizing then it was the pilot, co-pilot.
All 7 family members that were in the house when the airplane crashed 100 feet away survived the violent explosion and fire. But the pilot, Captain John Rooks, and radar navigator, First Lieutenant Larry L. Thomas of the Air National Guard based in Des Moines, Iowa, were tragically killed. One of the thousands of servicemen who worked at the base at the time was Terry Greenfield, who now lives in Story City and who has been a longtime friend of our families. It was only when we started producing this podcast that Terry contacted us to let us know that he actually served with and knew Captain Rooks and First Lieutenant Thomas.
I enlisted in 1964 and stayed till 1972. I was a sergeant. During this period, I was a staff sergeant during the crash. And then I got out for 10 years and I got back in for another 20, actually more than 20. I ended up with right at 30 years of service with the Air Force, Air National Guard, and Air Force Reserve. And I retired as a Chief Master Sergeant, which is the highest enlisted grade you can be. When I first started out, I was in personnel. During the crash, I was in personnel, and we took care of the enlisted records of about 1,000 people, and my partner took care of the officer records, which sat right next to each other. There's all over the base, counting ground officers, not just flyers, probably 150 officers. So I sat next to him. So when those guys would come in, I would see him and converse with him and talk to him. And some of the pilots were a little standoffish because I was a sergeant. These two guys, every time I watch Top Gun, I think of these guys. They were a pair. I mean, they flew together, loved together. They were just, to me, awesome Americans and awesome guys. That's why I remember them so well. And of course, after their death, it seared in my mind. A military mind is a little different than anybody else's. Once you set foot on government ground and basic training, you are made aware of regulations that you follow, and you don't deviate from them. You follow them to the nth degree. Pilots, a little different breed of person. I wouldn't say they have a death wish at all, but they love the adrenaline of feeling that jet engine push them up into the sky. I had a ride in F-16 back seat, and you can't describe the feeling. It was an awesome feeling. So I know they have a mindset of, you know, who in the world want to strap on two rockets, not just one, and fly into the sky and not for sure. You know, you hope that the mechanics did their job and they can get back down on the ground. Some of them don't make it back to base. And they were those two. They weren't the wild guys that you think about as pilots. They were just happy-go-lucky. They enjoyed what they were doing. Nobody makes them do that. I mean, they didn't have to do that. They didn't have to fly. They both had spent time before they came to the Air National Guard in the military. So they were just neat guys. I would say they were not the type of person that would take a lot of chances like Top Gun, you know, buzzing ships and doing that kind of low-level stuff to get people's excitement. We had a few of those guys in unit, but it wasn't these two. These two guys were pretty much by the book and what they should be, and they knew what they could do and couldn't do, but they had a good time doing it. They were pals, and you could see it when they were in the office because they almost always come in together. They were just awesome guys.
Another person who served with Captain Rooks and First Lieutenant Thomas was Leland Coburn. How we met Leland is rather interesting. My mom, Sigrid, had just started working at the dental office in town, and Leland, who is a patient, introduced himself. After hearing my mom's name, he looked at her in amazement and asked if she was one of the survivors of the plane crash in 1968.
My 6 years were up in November of 68. And this took place December 9th of 1968, so I'd just gotten out. I was in base operations, and when I'd get the word to scramble the pilots, I'd be down there, you know, and work with the pilots. So that was kind of my experience. The Rooks family was well known in the Eldora area. He, being from Eldora, we'd been in 4-H at the county fair different times, and I knew him from that. So when we were in Air National Guard, I visited a lot with him because we talked farming and 4-H days. Yeah, he was a nice fella and a very good pilot and was well respected.
Captain Rooks was honored in 1967 as Outstanding Air Crewman in Air Defense Units by the National Guard Bureau. He was 28 and was survived by his wife, Marcia, his 5-year-old daughter, Julie, and 1-year-old son, Matthew. His radar navigator, First Lieutenant Larry L. Thomas, who was 30, had served for 4 years in the Air Force before enlisting with the National Guard. He was survived by his wife, Mary Ann, his 7-year-old son, Michael, and 6-month-old daughter, Karen. First Lieutenant Thomas, his wife, and daughter were set to play Joseph, Mary, and the baby Jesus in their church's Christmas program the following Sunday.
Come to find out, his navigator that crashed with him that night was also a dairy farmer. I remember him saying that he'd gone to Iowa State and got a college degree, and he had his degree on the barn, but he didn't know if that helped the cow's milk anymore, milk or not, you know, he joked about that. Me being a farmer, we discussed farming a lot, so we would sit and visit a lot, so I probably knew those two guys more than any of the other pilots.
My relationship with the two guys, they were friends. In personnel and in medics, where I ended up taking care of 1,200, 1,300 people, I was hospital administrator for the medical unit and taking care of all those records. So you get to know people really pretty well, and especially flying people. They had to do records check and make sure everything was all okay, because we were scheduled for protecting this area in the United States from the Gulf to the Canadian border. And this was our area with these airplanes that we protected. It was those days when people built bomb shelters. We thought our enemies would bomb us or would send planes over. Our mission with the airplane was to shoot down, dogfight the planes coming over. And also there was a threat because Offutt Air Force Base had a lot of missile silos around. That's not classified. Everybody knows that. And that's not far away. So in that day and age, nuclear capabilities were hot and heavy and threatened at each other. So we felt it was real. In fact, we had night flying quite a bit because we didn't know when the threat was going to come in, if it was going to come in. We had pilots sleeping at the base, and they were on call, and their jets were ready to be powered up and take off within just a few minutes. We were under Air Defense Command at that time, and we had about, I think it was about two or three states wide, all the way from the Gulf to Canadian border.
The Des Moines Register reported that Air National Guard General Roger W. Gilbert said the plane that crashed was one of three F-89 jets that took off from Des Moines at 5:50 p.m. on the evening of December 9th. He said they were on a 90-minute training mission with a B-58 bomber, practicing medium-level intercepting.
I think they were going north when they were dogfighting, and at that time we're in a passageway that we were allowed, the federal government and the state allowed us to fly fairly low. That's why you may have heard jets a few times, not because they were landing in Des Moines. It's because this was their dogfighting area. After that, they moved it over to the Boone Valley area, where they followed the river a lot, where they weren't disturbing a lot of people.
The scrambling of the pilots, usually there were three pilots who would go up at a time, and they'd just go through a mission. They had a different mission different times, and I really don't know exactly what those missions were, but there were usually three of the F-89 jet fighter planes and their pilots that would go up for that. Scrambling is when you've got all the pilots' names up on a board, and they'll tell me which three. And so I'd holler out those three names of those guys, and they would run to their planes and take off on a mission. And the pilots never knew for sure. They were just sitting around in the operations area waiting to be called upon, you know.
Everyone we spoke with and everything we've read about Captain Rook's airplane said it was very difficult to fly. Developed in the late 1940s, right after World War II, the F-89 was one of the first production jets for the U.S. military. So when it was created, there was still a lot to be learned about how to design a safe jet fighter. They called it the Scorpion because of its strange tail configuration that looked similar to a scorpion's. This was an attempt to remedy its poor aerodynamics. Making things even worse, the fuel tanks were mounted to the tips of the wings. You can imagine how the fuel would slosh around, making it that much more difficult to fly. The F-89 was actually decommissioned from the U.S. military in 1969, less than a year after the crash.
That F-89J, we used to call it the lead sled, because it took the whole runway to get off the ground. It was a very clumsy, straight-out wings, not aerodynamic at all. It was a fairly slow airplane. They were the first jets that we had at the base. They were old. That's back when the Air National Guard got mostly hand-me-down equipment. In a modern aircraft, I think they could have pulled out. But I'm trying to make sure I don't say anything classified. The pilot and the radar observer, and that's all he does in the back. He can't fly the airplane. he just watches the radar for incoming planes. And in some airplanes, he has control of dropping bombs or the machine guns that are mounted on the airplanes. So it can't fly without two people. They both have to be in the cockpits.
I was just walking from the car to the house, and I happened to look west, and I saw this big glow. And I thought, that's a strange sunset. And then it disappeared. And I thought, that is strange. But I thought, I'll find out more later, what it was all about. And that night I had a bowling league and was up in Radcliffe at the bowling alley. And I guess that night somebody came into the bowling alley and said they thought an airliner had crashed over by Story City. And, that may be what I saw. Maybe could have been. And nothing much more was mentioned. And later on somebody else came in and said, that was an Air National Guard jet that went in. And my first comment was, I hope it wasn't John Rooks and his navigator, not knowing that's who it was.
They'd been dogfighting with some other airplanes, and they got behind the other airplanes and didn't know where they were. And the instruments, they didn't believe. It's called spatial disorientation. Picture this, they could have been at fairly high altitude and got turned upside down, and they thought they were losing altitude, and they pulled back on the stick, which would be the opposite, accelerated in a dive with the afterburners on. So they were going the fastest that airplane, it's not even made to go that fast. And by the time they realized what had happened, it was way too late.
We lost things, but we didn't lose a husband, a son, a father, a brother, And they lost far more than we ever did. And that's the hard part.
We have not seen the official report from the investigation. None of the public reports tell us exactly how Captain Rooks ended up upside down, losing control of the aircraft. What we do know is the F-89 was an incredibly difficult plane to fly, even for a skilled pilot like Captain Rooks, and was not designed for extreme maneuvers necessary in a dogfight scenario. We also know that the aircraft was going so fast that First Lieutenant Thomas hit the tail of the airplane as he was ejected from the cockpit, and his parachute ripped from the extreme speed. Even if he had not hit the tail, they were already so close to the ground when he ejected, the parachute wouldn't have had any time to open. What I would like to believe is that Captain Rooks was able to guide the plane to the least populated spot he could find. And where his airplane hit, with him in it, on Falling Low Farm, right next to the concrete corn crib, full of 10,000 bushels of grain, miraculously spared the lives of my family. Even though the Chernoggle family lost all of their physical possessions, they walked away with their lives, and their community immediately came to their aid. Next time on Falling Low.